This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Today's show was pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take your questions and comments. Later in the show, we'll talk with historian David McCullough about the American spirit and hear about the caterpillar that brainwashed the wasp. But first, Great Dixter in East Sussex, England, was the family home of gardener and gardening writer Christopher Lloyd. Today, the estate is listed in England's Register of Historic Parks and Gardens and admired by gardeners from around the world. Lloyd appointed Fergus Garrett head gardener of Great Dixter in 1992. Garrett will be in Cincinnati to give a presentation on designing with plants the Great Dixter way Thursday evening at the Mercantile Library. I recently spoke with him by phone from the Great Dixter Estate in Sussex. Fergus, thank you for joining me today.
It's a pleasure.
Now, many listeners who are not avid gardeners might not be aware of Great Dixter, so can you give us some history about Great Dixter?
Yes, I think it's well known for being the home of the late Christopher Lloyd, who was this extraordinary character who died 10 years ago, but it was a place where he grew up and gardened and wrote from, and he was one of our greatest gardeners of all time, and undoubtedly one of the greatest garden writers of all time. And so it was a house that he was born in, but the core of the house dates back to the 15th century. It dates back to 1440, and it's a medieval manor house, which means that it was one of those sort of immense wooden frame buildings that was built for, you know, a lord and a lady, somebody who was pretty high up in the feudal system, and it was essentially one communal living space with a lot of private quarters for the family, but it was just this one floor-to-ceiling hall room where they had a fire in the center and pretty primitive living, really. And over the years, it became fashionable to sort of compartmentalize those and make them more comfortable. But it was a typical building of the 15th century in this area, you know, this area of Sussex, where oak was plenty and there's plenty of mud. And so it was oak framed with wattle and door with tile roofs. But Christopher's family didn't own it from the start. They only bought it in 1910, when Christopher's father, who was a lithographic printer, had made quite a bit of money up in the city in London, so he wanted a country home. So he bought this old building, which was rather down on one knee. It was, you know, it's been in on the estate agent's books for over 10 years, and it was rented out as a shooting lodge, but it was in a pretty dilapidated state. And so he commissioned that great architect, Sir Edwin Lutyens, to come and restore the house and make it comfortable for the family. So Lutyens restored the great hall and he replaced some of the timbers. But he also added living quarters for the family. So he built on this immense wing, which has, you know, the kitchen units and all of that. So extraordinary wing. And then they added another building onto the back as well and made this massive manor house that sits at the center of this garden. And so Lutyens was there for a couple of years. I mean, he was a much celebrated English architect of his time. Worked with Gertrude Jekyll on many projects, but Jekyll didn't work on Dixter. But Lutyens also designed the gardens and compartmentalized it into a series of rooms. And the Lloyd family lived there for many, many years. And at the end, it was just Christopher who was the head of the place. So he had the house, he gardened from the garden, he wrote from the garden, he set up a little nursery, and he became a much celebrated writer. And he lived it in an old-fashioned way with some wonderful old furniture. He didn't have television, you know, he didn't know. I don't remember when Paul McCartney came to visit him. He didn't even know who Paul McCartney or the Beatles were. He had never been sort of exposed to that, but he was just top of his field in terms of gardening and horticulture. And he was well known as being somebody who was just very dynamic with colour, somebody who experimented a lot, somebody who was inspirational and so created this voluptuous garden that swallows up the house and sits around the house and you move through it from one room to another.
I have seen pictures of this and it is remarkable. It's beautiful and it's inspiring, Fergus.
Yes, it's an inspirational place, like you say, because it's so free in the way that it experiments with plants. So we try new combinations all the time. It never stands still, the garden, and it's all about this free thinking in terms of design, because we feel that it's an art form. Gardening is a very complex art form. So you wouldn't ask a painter to paint the same picture over and over and over again. So we're constantly, you know, just flicking little changes here and there. Obviously, we're dealing with living things, so we study Mother Nature really carefully and work out the layers of planting and so on. And so it's a place that is very, very inquisitive in the way that it handles plants. But also it's a place that's seeped in history as well. It's got that romantic charm about it. You know, the old walls have got cracks in it, and so vegetation comes out of those. There's 400-year-old grass room with the tapestry of wildflowers that comes running up to the walls of the garden and in the garden itself. The old paving stones are worn under foot traffic. And so this has an intimacy as a result of age and as a result of the vegetation taking over the place. And also it has a domestic intimacy as well, because it's still a home. And so although it's a garden that's open to the public, you feel as though you've walked into a private paradise going into it.
How did you come to be involved with Great Dixter and Christopher Lloyd?
Well, Christopher studied modern languages at Cambridge, but that was interrupted by the war, so he went and did his military service. And when he came out of the military, he went to a university called Y College. Y College was part of London University, and this was outside of London, near Canterbury, but it did all the land-based studies, like tropical sciences, agriculture, and horticulture. So he read horticulture there, and after a few years became one of the teaching staff, and he taught there for several years as a professor, but then went back to Dixter to work from home. And one of his pupils, in a few years' time, became head of horticulture at Y College. And I went to Y to study horticulture. You know, so along I came along, and he was my head of studies, this great man called Tom Wright. And Tom saw something in me, and so he introduced me to Christopher. And then a friendship blossomed out of that, and so we kept in touch. And I worked abroad in the south of France or in Gestaden, Switzerland, and various other bits and work. And out of the blue, Christopher asked me to be his head gardener way back in 1992. And so I initially said no, because I had already had a relationship with the place and him, and I thought if I worked there, that bubble may burst. But he said, you know, absolutely not. This is going to be your place as much as mine. And so I joined him. We continued being the greatest friends. He became a part of my family, and I became part of the furniture of the place, and I was never, ever disappointed in making that decision. So I joined him as head gardener, and that's 25 years on. I'm still head gardener and chief executive here, and run the place in a similar way, so that it has its atmosphere and its sense of place and character.
Do you maintain the gardens based on Christopher Lloyd's approach and philosophy to gardening?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's the same philosophy. But that in itself means that there's a big element of change within it, because Christopher never wanted us to pick up a book, one of his books, read up a combination and mimic that and say it's a Christopher Lloyd garden. His philosophy was experiment, try new combinations, build on your successes, get rid of plants if they're not doing the right thing, bring new plants in it, and make that garden live and be alive and move forward so it's like a dynamic painting. So we absolutely carry on in that same way, and we embrace a team of young and old that shares it with us. But if we like pink and yellow together, we don't feel we've got to put pink and yellow together just because it's a Christopher Lloyd garden. Because the way Christopher would work is that for a few years he'd obsess on pink and yellow, put pink and yellow, pink and yellow, pink and yellow together, and then he'd say, well, I've done that. I want to try white on white. Then he'd put white on white together. And so he was always going on to pastures new. And so, but doing it in a natural way, not for the sake of change, but for the sake of just learning new things and that inquisitiveness, which is so important. So we try and do it in exactly the same natural way without feeling pressure from outside.
Fergus, how many acres is the Great Dixter Estate, and how much of that is garden area?
Well, we've got about 50 acres in total, but only 6 acres of that is garden. of intensive garden. And beyond that, we've got, you know, the other sort of 44 acres are pasture land, meadow land, ancient woodland. But we're managing the whole thing as a whole because we have this extraordinary biodiversity study that's going on, that where it highlights all the insects and all the different bees and all of those things that are on our estate. And then we sort of target the management of land to sort of suit their needs. And so we've got, for instance, we've got over a third of the UK bee species count. We've got 108 species of bee on this estate, which makes us of national importance as far as bees are concerned. And so we're very careful in that we target the ones that are endangered or rare, so increase their habitat. So the whole estate is managed like that, with the garden sitting at the center of it.
So is Great Dixter Garden really a variety of several different gardens?
Yes, it is. You know, within that 6-acre estate, you'll pass through areas that have got a lot of paving, with plants coming out the paving and very formal, colorful areas. Then you'll go on to areas which are just grass with these extraordinary shapes carved out of you, our topiary pieces that come out of it. Then you'll go through a tropical garden with sort of subtropical plants giving you a feel of the tropics. In there to mixed borders, to stock beds, to ponds, to wilder areas, meadow areas that then go into woodland. So within that, it's very varied within that 6-acre site, with the house sitting right in the center of all of this.
How much work is it to maintain 6 acres of gardens?
It's as much work as you want it to be, I think. This is a very intensive garden, so we have 4 full-time gardeners, plus students and volunteers that keep this place going. But I've gardened this place with 1.5 people, but it just means that you experiment less and you teach less. And I think one of our big missions is to teach the next generation, you know, so that we help produce the new head gardeners of the future or point them in the right direction. And in fact, we have a lot of North American students that come and use this. And very often, in some years, we'll have, you know, I think last year we had a 3-year waiting list for students. So we have to be very careful not to keep those people waiting for too long. But it's just a very highly regarded place. And so we, you know, when we're seed sowing, instead of doing 1 or 2 packets of seed, I'll do a whole variety because I want kids to learn the differences and experience what I've experienced in my sort of long years of gardening. So we make it quite intensive, the whole place, but we could garden it in a less intensive way if we wanted, but we'd achieve less.
How much of the garden is self-sowing? How many of the plants and flowers are self-sowing, and why is that important?
I would say about a tenth of the garden is self-sowing. And people may think that's not a lot, but actually that is a lot, because a tenth of this sort of having this generation that goes on is, you know, there can be high maintenance, those self-sowers, because you have to thin them out and you have to make sure they land in the right place, or if they don't land in the right place, you have to edit them and so on. And I think that's really important for us to have an element of that, because they throw up all sorts of surprises. Not only that, you know, when it's forget-me-not time, the whole garden has a wave of blue forget-me-nots running through it. When it's cow parsley time, the whole garden floats in a mist of chalky white. When it's verbascum time, the whole garden is punctuated by these yellow candelabras. When it's verbena bonariensis time, and so on and so on and so on. So they come wave after wave after, and they link the garden together, even though the general planting in each one of those rooms may be different. So that's really important in that softening that picture. But they also throw up extraordinary combinations that we perhaps wouldn't have thought of. You know, suddenly you've got a pink flower that's flowering, into it lands this orange poppy. And so you've got orange and pink together in shades that you perhaps wouldn't have thought of putting together. And then you analyze that, and if you like it and it creates a reaction, you then sort of take it and mimic that with other plants using those colors, or perhaps the two plants that were already there. And so it's a catalyst to other things, which is also quite interesting. But they are a lot of work. But there are ways around the work, actually, because you can mulch a lot of the garden, just leave a few pockets unmulched for the self-sows to come. So there's always a way around it.
I'm talking with Fergus Garrett, who will be at the Mercantile Library on October 5th to talk about the Great Dixter Garden. And Fergus, there's section of the garden called the Long Border. I'm wondering if you can describe that to us.
The Long Border is world famous, really. It's near enough 200 feet long. It's 15 feet deep. But, you know, all of this can be scaled up or scaled down. And it's a mixed border. And by that, I mean it has all those elements of trees, shrubs, perennials, annuals, the whole lot in together. Rather than just saying this is going to be a perennial border or this is going to be an annual border, we mix our material so that you have the greatest number of textures, the greatest number of seasons, the greatest range of colors to work with. And it's a border that's well known for its long season. So basically from April through to end of October, it's colorful. And we do that by a number of ways, sometimes by underplanting and interplanting with bulbs that have then become permanent, sometimes by having plants that self-sow into the space, sometimes by having pockets of evergreen things that look good every single day of the year, and sometimes by, you know, popping in a dahlia here and there and choosing the right plants that give us a long season through their flowering and so on. So an extraordinary border that is iconic and highly regarded in the world. And it was Christopher's setup. You know, he fine-tuned it over a number of years to get it to this point. And so we add new plants to it by all means, but we maintain the principles of it.
He kept fine-tuning it. Talk about that, Fergus. How important is change to a garden, whether it be at Great Dixter or it be at a home garden?
I think that people do approach it in different ways. And some people just like it as it is, and they want to maintain it, but they just cut things down. They mow and blow and tidy up and throw mulch down, and that's it. And that's their green space with flowers, and they love it, and that's it. And that ticks their box. Whereas for us, we feel that it's an art form. And in the same way that we don't want to be painting the same painting over and over again, we want to be a part of the fun of it for us is to be creative with different colors and different plants. And so there is a fluid element where we're changing the planting to just as we're experimenting with new schemes or new color combinations or new plants. And that, for somebody who's worked in the same garden for 25 years, that keeps you alive, actually, because you're looking forward to the next combination, the next combination. You're inquisitive about the new plant that's coming. You're then looking at it to see, assess it, to see if you can put it with, you know, various colors or various other plants to evoke a certain feeling. You know, exotic garden, for instance, with all these subtropical leaves, if you start putting bright colors of cannas and dahlias in it, you feel as though you're in a Costa Rican jungle, if you like. Not that I've ever been in a Costa Rican jungle, but then you've put conifers in there and take those bright colors out, and suddenly the temperature comes down and you feel as though you're in the Himalayas rather than being, you know, so that sort of thing is just like a catalyst to you. It gives you energy and keeps you going forward. And so I think for a garden like Dixter, that's got a dynamic element running through its blood. It's the life and soul of a place like this. If we set it in aspect and just maintained it and stood it still, it would gather dust very, very quickly. So that's us. But you go to another place where it's a representation of, say, an 18th century garden, and all the plants are 18th century, and it's a historic museum piece. Well, in a situation like that, by all means, keep the garden as it was. But ours is a painting. And the creative element in it is so important. So that's why we keep it changing in the same way that Christo kept it changing.
And just a few simple changes can give it a whole different feel, can't it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It makes it just so a visitor coming to this place from one year to another, there's an element of surprise because they don't quite know what they're going to see. Now, having said that, we don't change all of it. We only change parts of it, but just a few changes will make all of that difference. But having said this, you know, there's a fine balance here. So, and the balance in a place like Dixter is keeping Dixter, so keeping it familiar, but also keeping it different every time as well. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And I think so it's important not to garden it with an ego. it's important not to think, well, actually, Christopher's gone now. It's now a Fergus Garrett garden, so I need to stamp my mark on it to make my... So I'm going to redesign this part of the garden. You know, all of that's wrong. Whereas if you make a change because it's an improvement, and you, then I think it's the right way of going about it rather than forcing a change just to make a splash.
Gardening's long been a passion in Great Britain. Do you see a difference in how Americans view their gardens?
I think the tradition is longer and runs deeper in Britain. But you know what? From the students and the young that are coming through, coming over the pond over to us, the stronger students we've been getting the last few years have been all been American students. In terms of their energy, their enthusiasm, their drive and knowledge, I think there's some really exciting things going on there. And that's, you know, there's been this boom in horticultural places in the last few years, you know, I would say in the last 15 years or so, where there's been some extraordinary gardens and gardeners that have come to light. Places like Chanticleer, for instance, places like Wave Hill, there's also so much going on on the West Coast as well, and there's some extraordinary plant people, nursery people, gardeners, designers, and some extraordinary nurseries as well. And you guys have got a greater sense of freedom than we have. You haven't got the hang-ups that the British gardeners have got of saying, oh, you know, it must be good taste and it must be this. And so I think in terms of excitement, I would say that what I see in the States is more exciting than what I see in Britain. And I wouldn't have said that 15 years ago, but I say that now because there's been a real energy. Now, you're a big country, and there may be a lot of people who are not even gardening in the way that I'm talking about. But, you know, the spark is there, the energy, the vitamin pill is there. And so I think this it's really exciting.
While you're in Cincinnati, do you have any plans to tour any of the local gardens here?
Oh, I can't wait, actually. I can't wait to see the gardens there. And also, I can't wait if there's any way of seeing any sort of wild flora there. I'm very much interested in that as well. Then you get to real grips with the countryside. But, you know, I've been to America a lot. And every single time I go, I get inspired. You know, not only by the people and your attitude, but also by just everything is, in a way, is different, and there's an energy about it, so I can't wait to come over.
Fergus, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Fergus Garrett will present Designing with Plants the Great Dixter Way at the Mercantile Library Thursday evening from 5 to 7:30. The event is hosted by Betsy and Paul Sittenfeld in partnership with the Garden Conservancy. You can find a link to more information on our website, wvxu.org. Coming up, we'll talk with historian David McCullough about the values he believes we should all embrace as Americans. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.